Hello, Natalie. How are you?
I'm good, thank you, Simon. How are you?
Yeah, I'm really, really good. Thank you. Look, thank you so much for giving up your time to do this. Really appreciate it.
Oh, no, appreciate you asking me. So it's all good.
Good. Well, we've had a conversation before and found out a bit about you. And there's a lot, there is so much to your story. And there's a lot that interests me personally as well from the sales industry, which will lead us into your story and life before what happened to you. Perhaps you could take us from the top. Tell us about what you were doing in your career, what you were doing in sales.
I've had quite a varied sales career, I suppose, insofar as when I came out of university back in the, oh crikey, late 90s, I say very non-specific there, and I actually went into, first of all, automotive consumable market. And when I say that, people go, what's that? And it's nothing fancy. It was brake cleaners, screws, nuts, bolts, things for body shops. And so I was trained up. It was a German company, very good company. They're still running now. Blue chip, great sales training. And I was out and about on the road, going to the single-handed garages, back street garages. This is, I'm 21 years old, got on my own in Birmingham, which is where I was living, and right through to your dealership. So it was tough. It was a tough start into sales. Late 90s, being a female, a young female, going into that environment, you can imagine. I blame that for my slightly bad language that I have nowadays. So you had to hold your own in that very male-dominated environment as it was then.
I
And
bet it was. You cut your teeth there, didn't you? Right at the heart of sales. That couldn't have been easy.
it wasn't, and it's direct sales. So you literally had to get your orders, and they were had to be processed and signed. Like it was as, you're measured on that. There's no ambiguity about what you were getting. The other thing is you'd have to go and ask from the single-handed garages, especially for checks to clear their account, because their accounts, you get this list, you get this list of accounts on hold. And they say, right, can you go into these? Great, that's an awkward conversation. Imagine you're starting your conversation with, well, before we have this conversation, could I have some money? Oh, and now I've come to sell you some more stuff and get an order. So you were the debt collector and the salesperson.
I'm not generalizing at all, but I'm telling you, in a few years ago, car garages, you're a young lady working in. Were you intimidated in any way? What was the
They were tough. I think I came from an automotive background, I suppose. My dad was a car mechanic. He was also a rally driver. So I'd grown up going to car rallies, my dad doing all different stages, being around a lot of mechanics. My dad's own garage as well. So I think that helped set me up as a bit of a tough nut on that. And it was hard, things got said. I think I was probably a little bit gobbier than I am now. That's actually not true. It probably was just as gobby. But so I could hold my own. And luckily, my dad had a garage that specialised in Rolls and Bentley and stuff like that, 'cause that was his interest. Not far away from where I was working. And they all knew that my dad was that crazy Portuguese bloke who owned the garage down there. So they probably left me alone a bit.
Yeah, thank goodness for him. I mean, the early part of anyone's sales career, I know my own, when you're learning it and you're getting into the way of sales, I have such fond memories. Do you still remember stuff that you learned in those early days?
Yeah, because those early days, as tough as they were, I tell you what, they set me up so well. I mean, resilience is absolutely key. You don't realize when you're 20-something year old actually that you were building up this resilience, but you were. I could be sat in the car, you'd have to take this deep breath and you'd walk in, and then you could walk out with the most amazing sale that you weren't expecting. You come out with this order and it's huge. And there were funny moments that, oh gosh, I remember one time coming out, I got this lovely suit on. So we had to wear our suits. We were, an organization that was very well presented. And I remember getting out my white Escort. That's how old you are. Getting out my white Escort. And this German Shepherd Alsatian coming running along, and I sort of stood there slightly frozen, thinking, okay. And it came up, sniffed me, sniffed my car, and then promptly cocked its leg up the side of my white Escort. And I was just sort of stood there horrified, going, what am I doing? But I got a great sale because the guy felt so bad that his dog had peed at my car that actually he placed a big order that day. So I
Good
think we
sales
all have
tactic.
those moments. Yeah, we all have those moments. And it really set me up well. It set me up to sort of hold my shoulders back and take a deep breath and just go forward no matter what. And you know what, sometimes the best things can happen when you don't expect it, and sometimes you'll get a blow and you have to get yourself back up from that. And that's sales, you know that.
I know that. My next question is, do you think it takes a sort of person that can ride those waves?
I think you do have to be quite a determined individual. I think you keep using this word resilience, but you do have to have a mental resilience, because sales is hard. You know, I went from the automotive, I then went into homewares, I was selling to cash and carries and cookshops, and then right up to Next and Debenham for their cookware department before joining the pharmaceutical industry. But all three of those industries, and I was in the pharmaceutical industry 19 years in total, I was in the pharmaceutical industry when what happened to me happened, as we'll talk about soon. And but all of them needed their own resilience in a particular way. You take your blows, you take your step back. Sometimes I think salespeople can be treated with a degree of disdain, if I'm honest. If you're a field sales representative, there's this older sales reps here, oh, the rolling of the eyes. And you have to look past that, and you have to connect with that person no matter what you're faced with. You have to put on that smile, and you have to find that mutual path, isn't it? I mean, that's what sales is about. You discover their need and you sell to that need, but you've got to build this rapport. You have to have rapport, and therefore you have to, in sales, be able to put certain things behind you and still go on and put this happy face on, build this rapport and move forwards. And
that's
I do think
face.
That's a certain person. Yes.
It can be exhausting. And the reason I'm going over this conversation is because there's so much more to you than what happened, and that you were on a sort of trajectory at the time in your career, weren't you? Because you brushed over the fact that you were in pharma sales. I mean, you were working with some pretty big logos.
Yeah, I worked for AstraZeneca, who are a massive pharmaceutical company. Astra have been a UK-based company for years and years, and they developed their key drug was a drug called Losec, and that was massive, massive, massive drug in the UK. So AstraZeneca, they're based down in Luton. Great company, we've saved them 10 and a half years. I then moved to Roche, Roche Products, and they do a lot of the cancer drugs. So the big drugs that we know about, like Herceptin for breast cancer, it was groundbreaking for ladies with breast cancer. And they've done lots of amazing drugs since. And I was with Roche for about 9 years. And it was a great company. I've gone through sales, through, I was in medical affairs. I've done training. I'm a qualified coach. And I've also done what they call market access. So when a new drug comes to market, like a chemotherapy drug, you have to make sure that hospital departments are ready for it. You've got to speak to the decision makers to say, this is how many patients you're going to get, and let's get prepared. So that's the point I was at when my life changed, is that I was now as a market access manager.
Yeah, and you were doing very well. I know you're modest, but you told me before that people were looking up to you as the top of your game. And you mentioned what happened. Was about to happen, and this was the situation that you were in at the time. Can you talk us through the 3 days that led up to it, how normal everything was in your eyes?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, let me take you
into
the scenario. I was 8 months pregnant, and I decided to take a week annual leave from my job before I'd start my maternity leave. It's obviously just the way I'd had annual leave to use up. We can all appreciate that, I'm sure. There's plenty of ladies in the business that will understand that you try to use your annual leave up so you can save your maternity leave for as long as possible for when you've got the baby. So I was taking a week's annual leave, and I'd been in hospital for a couple of days. I was there finishing off my emails on my last day of work, desperately getting contractions, getting pains on the phone to my midwife, and midwife saying, go to hospital. I'm like, in just a minute, there, I've just got to sign up, I've just got to do my out of office. And my boss thought I was mental when I told him. And then after having had the scare of the contractions and thinking that little one was going to be premature, I then had the Monday through to the Friday when my life changed. Completely normal at home. My two children were at school, got at the time a 10-year-old and a 6-year-old. My 10-year-old, I remember, was vomiting on the Monday. Kids are wonderful, that you've just come out of hospital, you've got a lot to deal with. I was trying to get ready for maternity leave, and then I've got a child with, you know, a sickness and diarrhea bug. So it's just a normal sort of trying to deal with her and going to the midwife. On the Wednesday of that week, I remember going to the midwife and sorting out my birth plan, talking to my partner about all the different elements because we were getting close to it, you know, sort of who's going to cut the cord, is it going to be natural birth, all the things that everyone goes through, any normal couple will go through. And that Thursday night, when I reflect back on it, I was sat on the sofa, I got my bump, my partner was lying across my lap, we've got quite a long sofa, I got my feet on the sort of chaise-longs, it makes me sound posh, doesn't it? I come from Birmingham, but I can be posh with my chaise-long. So I got my feet upon the chaise-long, and he was lying across, chatting to the bump, and he was my partner. We weren't married at this point. We talked about getting married. He's somebody I'd known for, crikey, many, many years. We'd gone to grammar school together in our younger years. We got together later in life as a couple. So I got married, had two children, and then got together with him about a year after I split from my husband. So here we were having our first child together, a child that he very much wanted. And that night was him chatting away to his baby, saying, hello, it's daddy. And we were preparing, he had a speech to deliver at a formal dinner at the weekend. So we were actually sat there, me on the iPad, him on the phone, looking at facts and figures that he could put into his speech for that Saturday, for the formal dinner.
Yeah, he had his own business, didn't he?
Yeah, so my partner, Bobby, he owned, really, a car garage, which is quite spooky, I've never thought about that, but not because he was mechanically minded, it was actually just a business proposition that came up, and him and his business partner took it on. They specialised in Mercedes, and it was just something that filled a niche in Birmingham that was there. He was, like I say, not mechanically minded at all. He was just there as a businessman. So he was director of this company. So on the day of the attack, he got up as normal and went to work and went to his business.
Okay. So, and obviously hindsight is the only perfect science as we look back over events. Did you recollect, did you see anything different about anything that night before or the morning?
Between. No, and so for those listening in, I guess obviously we're going to talk about the fact that I was attacked on that Friday and the perpetrator turned out to be my partner. And the thing is that no, the night before, he was completely normal and we went to bed and cuddled up in bed. And that morning, he was all cuddles and kisses and chatting about the day and that we needed to go to the bank and that we need to sort some money out that afternoon and why don't we go for lunch or why don't we grab a coffee. Totally normal morning, normal night before, literally nothing at all.
And I think you'd received a text to say something had been booked in, some treatment had been booked in a few days.
Yeah, the night we were going to do this hypnobirthing class, which both of us found a bit hilarious because it was the days before I got into yoga. I'm well into all my yoga and meditation now, but this was before those days. And we were sort of saying, let's do this hypnobirthing. Lots of people say it's really good for pain control. And there's a course, and it was a one-to-one course, £150 for the two of us to spend a day with this hypnobirth coach, and she would take us through it. And we booked it on the Thursday night. He paid for it. And on the Friday morning, weirdly, I got an email confirming our place, which I sent that email on to him, and you know, I received a very nice sort of email reply back from him at that lunchtime. So everything normal.
You'd had a lovely evening the night before, you'd kissed each other goodbye, you've got plans, you're making plans together, he was making plans for you for 3 days into the future. In your own words now, Natalie, just talk us through the day that changed your life.
So woke up in the morning, as I say, and Bobby got himself ready and dashed off to work, all hugs and kisses and chatting about things ahead. I went to my daughter's assembly, so I rushed around and got the kids ready, as per usual, for school and dashed off the school run slightly late. That's kind of standard for me. And got them there. Yeah, I am a bit bad at timing, I'll be honest. Got them into assembly and I was sat there with my ex-husband, who I still got on totally fine with, still do to this day. We've always had a good friendship, even though we divorced, we always maintained a good friendship. So I'm sat with him my 10-year-old's the lead role in her assembly. I'm sat there filming her. My 6-year-old is sat down in that assembly. At the end, it's all hugs and kisses. I'm the embarrassing mom shouting across the hall, goodbye, love you, kisses, waving them off. And, you know, I think back to that day, I've still got on my phone footage that I filmed of my daughter in assembly that day. And you think, I was sat there completely oblivious that in just 6 hours after I sat there, that I'd be fighting for my life. You know, I'm just sat there. I was in my gym kit, pregnant. I dashed to the gym afterwards. I went to Sainsbury's shopping. As I was around the shop, Bobby phoned to say, could I meet him at the bank at 3 o'clock, I think was the original time. Then it swapped to 3:30. We talked about what we were having for dinner. I remember it was going to be salmon, which is a weird thing that's always stuck in my head. We talked about the weekend. It was Mothering Sunday that weekend. Everything was so, so normal. It's crippling how mundane it was, to be fair. You know, insofar as there's no warning signs. He then calls me when I got back home. So I'm there unpacking the shopping and he phones me and says, the appointment's been moved to 3:30. Have you got someone to collect the kids from school? And I said, I've got my mum to collect the kids because originally I thought the appointment was 3:00, so I won't be back anyway. So mum's going to collect the kids. He goes, right. He goes, I'm going to come and pick you up. And I said, no, I can walk into Sutton. Don't be daft. Because it's about 20-minute walk from my house. And I love going out, walking, exercise. And he said, no, you've been to the gym this morning, you're just been in hospital, you're 8 months pregnant, you're not walking, I'm going to pick you up. And I was saying no, and the only thing that flickers about that conversation is he said to me, you're not going to walk, but if you do, which way will you go? And I said, what, you a stalker? What? Like joking. And for a split second, his voice changed. And he went, don't say that, that's not us. I was like, oh, okay, I'm only joking. And then I said, oh, I'll walk the normal way past the hospital over down Trinity Hill. He went, oh, that's fine. He said, and he went back to being normal him. And he just sort of said, oh, that's fine, but you're not walking. I'm going to be there in the next half hour. And I got off the phone. I was a bit sort of put out thinking, why did he bite my head off about that joke? And but I carried on. And I remember looking at my watch thinking, well, it's 3:55. The appointment's 3:30. He'd called me, I think, about 2:00, so he's really late now, you know, 55 minutes sort of thing, or 50 minutes. I thought, I'm going to leave the house, and I'm going to start walking. I'll phone him, and he can pick me up en route if necessary, that's fine. So I left the house, I phone him as I'm walking out, and I'm walking down the road, and I call him, and he answers, and he was fine. I've literally replayed this message at the conversation so many times, and he was fine normally. He just said, I'm sorry. Oh God, babe, I'm sorry. I'm stuck in traffic. I'm still on the other side of Birmingham. I'm not on the Aston Expressway even. And I said, that's okay, darling. I'm just walking down. I'm going to go to the shop. So just call me when you get there. And he goes, oh, I'm really sorry. I was meant to be there to pick you up. Sorry, I didn't call. I was like, don't be daft. And he goes, well, I've got to go now. And I just thought, he might have been being naughty and holding the phone, or he's driving and he's got the phone. And I just said, okay, darling, I'll see you when I get there. And he goes, I love you. I said, love you too. And I just hung up and I carried on walking, and totally oblivious that in effect I was walking to my death. And I know that sounds very dramatic, but I was, you know, I was carrying on walking into Sutton. I've got my bump, I've got an umbrella up, it was raining. I remember halfway down thinking, it's actually raining really hard, should I go back and fetch the car? And I thought, no, don't be daft, because then Bob will bring his car, we'll have two cars in the centre, that's silly. Just carry on. And I pushed on, and I got to just outside Sutton Town Centre. So the scene is, I've crossed over this road, and there's a big church at the top of Sutton Town Centre called Holy Trinity Church. And behind it is a fairly wide, tree-lined walkway. And it's a pedestrianised section. It's like an alleyway, but it's quite wide. It's very nice. It goes behind the churchyard. And it goes down a steep hill, which then goes into a road that comes up. There's a ring road around the Sutton. There's this dead-end road that comes up to the pedestrianised bit. And then that literally, you walk down there and you're in the centre of Sutton. So you go down Trinity Hill, you get to the ring road, you cross over it, and you've literally, there's McDonald's, the bus stops, everything. So I'm at the top of Trinity Hill. And I remember thinking, oh, shall I walk down? It's a steep hill, it's a wet day. it's not actually somewhere I liked. I didn't say to you before, there's actually a murder had taken place there 20 years before. Sutton never has anything happen on it. Sutton Coldfield is a very nice suburb of Birmingham. It never has anything really particularly dramatic. And Trinity Hill, weirdly, had had a girl murdered there 20 years before. When I was at university in the 90s, it's 1996, I remember I'd come back, New Year's Eve, she was murdered and discovered on New Year's Day morning by, I think, the vicar or the vicar's wife. And there's a memorial that stands at the top of Trinity Hill, Nicola Dixon's memorial. And for some reason, I've never liked Trinity Hill. I've always found it a bit of a dark place in terms of feel, not physically, just feel. So I've always walked around the long way. I've never gone down it by myself until this day. And I thought, Natalie, don't be stupid. It's 3:10, it's a Friday afternoon, there's people walking up the hill, you can see the town centre ahead. What, just go down there, you're getting soaked. My bumper's getting wet, you know, it's sticking out of my jacket. So I made my way down, and as I'm going down the tree-lined alley, I hear this running behind me. And I glanced over my shoulder, I've got the umbrella up, so you can imagine it's a very limited view, so sort of looking down through the gap, and all I see is this scruffily dressed guy, hood up, head down, and he's got his scruffy jeans on and trainers, and he's running with his hands in his pockets. And I'm thinking, don't feel right, but he might just be running to the town centre because it's a cut through. So I sped up and I thought, if I get to that dead end road that I told you about that came up from Ring Road, if I get to the dead end road, I'll be fine. Because there's cars there, there's buildings there, there's a guy walking up the hill. So I sped up and I got there. Now, bearing in mind, I'm quite a fit person, so I'm walking at quite a pace, and I can hear this person still running, catching me up. I get to the dead end road, but I just tense, because without looking round, you know when you know someone stood behind you, because someone's so much in your physical space, you just know that someone stood very close by.
Yeah, you get that feeling.
Yeah, and I could just sense him. And I didn't need to look round, and I just thought, if I step to one side, I can make it clear I just want him to go past. You know where you do that very exaggerated sort of step, almost like, you know, go on, go through. Yeah. And I, just as I stepped across the one side, he jumped on me from behind. So you can imagine, I'm there completely unprepared for the fact he's going to jump on me. He jumps on me from behind. He grabs me. His arm came over me, so his arm is over me. He's grabbing me there. So he's behind me, and he's pulled me backwards into him. And I'm thinking I'm being mugged. My handbag's on that side. I've just come down an alleyway. I'm a pregnant female, thinking I probably look vulnerable. I'm ready. I'm screaming for him to get off. I'm trying to drop my handbag off my shoulder. And then at the corner of my eye, I suddenly see that in his right hand, he's pulled the 12-inch carving knife.
Sorry, I'm just taking this in. Literally taking this in. You've got so much. You're fearful. You're heavily pregnant. You're thinking that you could ditch your handbag. I can't. What went through your mind when you saw the blade?
So when I saw the blade, my first thought was, you don't need to do that. You can have my bag. You know, you just think, hold on, he's pulled a weapon because he's, you know, it's an armed attack or a mugging. You know, and I'm thinking, just take it. Just take my bag. Then I weirdly wondered whether it was attack on a sexual basis, because the way he'd grabbed me, he'd actually got his hand cupped on my right breast, and I thought, oh my God, is this a man who's got some strange thing for pregnant women? And because it was very intimate the way he was holding me. Now clearly, now I know it was my partner in disguise who was doing this, which I didn't know at the time because he was so disguised, and we'll talk about that obviously in a bit. But to him, it probably wasn't unusual because he was used to physically holding parts of me, whereas to me, I'm thinking it's a stranger. I'm thinking, hold on, this is wrong. But within a split second, he's brought that knife. My brain's there trying to process, and it's a strange thing when you're in a traumatic situation and an extreme traumatic situation. My response is to try and rationalize. So I'm going through that, is it a mugging? He can have my bag. Is it a sexual attack? Oh my God, how am I going to protect myself? Because, you know, my baby, I've got to protect myself. And then while my head's still going through this, all of a sudden this knife has come down and it's straight through my chest. So he literally just stabs it straight through the center of my chest. And I remember this sharp burning pain, the knife coming away, and I'm me thinking, I've just been stabbed. But I couldn't believe my head would not accept it. and I still had to look down to see that my top was ripped, I was bleeding, and I was. It was the only way. I almost had to look down and go, so I'm sure I've just been stabbed. And I knew I had, but I still had to go, oh my God, I have. Incessant. The blows just kept coming and coming and coming and coming. I can't break free. I'm now in survival mode. I'm screaming to the guy I had seen walking up the hill. I screamed to him. His name is John Mitchell. Johnny, as we've become friends now, I didn't know him at all. John Mitchell was coming home from work. He said he had his earphones in. He was walking up Trinity Hill. And he said he glanced up. He saw the attacker jump on me. He said he thought we were mates messing about. He said, then I saw your face. He said, I will never forget your face because I've never seen someone's face contorted with fear as much as yours was. He said it was just pure fear. And he said, I saw the knife. And then he had a terrible decision. Did he run? Does he call for help? Does he call the police? Does he run to help me? All of the above. You know, he had to process a lot and he went through a lot. He came running to my aid. What I didn't know is there was a man walking behind down the hill behind the attacker. I don't think the attacker realised either. So he's walking down. His name's Tony. He said from his perspective, he's walking down the hill. He sees this guy with a hooded top in front of him. He realises that the guy has grabbed somebody. He can hear the screams. So then all he saw was this knife coming down. Now this guy, Tony, I don't want to make sure I get his age right because I don't want to upset or be any disrespected. I believe it was 62 at the time. 62-year-old guy on his own, and he made the decision. He jumped on the attacker's back. So he then runs and he jumps to bring the attacker down, which is an incredibly, incredibly brave move. You know, he has no idea what he's dealing with. He can just see a hooded man with a knife who's stabbing somebody. He pulls him down. Johnny's also pulling on the attacker. So we now have four of us on the pavement because the attacker drags me. As he gets dragged down, he pulls me with him. We have four people on the pavement, two of them trying to stop him, the attacker, from stabbing me, but he continues. And again, my head doing the reasoning thing. I was apparently screaming. I do remember thinking it, but apparently I was screaming it. I was screaming to the attacker, why me? What have I done to you? Why are you doing this? Please stop. And I kept repeating it. Why me? What have I done to you? Because I couldn't understand what on earth was possessing this person to keep attacking me. I noticed that he wasn't attacking them. It was me. And I was thinking, what is it that I've done that's causing this attack on me? Now, at one point, Tony managed to hold the attacker's arm back that got the knife. And the attacker let go of me to get his own arm back. And at this split second, and this is where our bodies are incredible things, our mind and our body, our survival instinct, I suddenly realised that I was free. So I got to my feet. Don't know how. I'd been stabbed 20 times, they say, at this point. I go clutch my bump and I'm staggering down Trinity Hill and I can see all of Sutton Town Centre ahead of me. I can see everyone going about their normal Friday afternoon. I'm trying to call for help. Nobody can hear me. And I collapse. And apparently I collapsed face first. When I came round, I was still determined not to give in. I dragged myself to a brick pillar by a car park and I propped myself against it. And then I see the attacker has broken free. And then the attacker comes at me for a second time. He's walking towards me. It's like a horror movie. He's walking towards me with a knife. I can't get up. I literally have no more energy. The adrenaline that got me to my feet is gone. The blood loss is now huge, so I literally cannot get off the pavement. And it is like one of those horror movies, you know, where somebody sinisterly, he walked. The thing, the most sinister thing about it was that he walked towards me. He didn't run, so it was almost like slow motion. And the guys who had been holding him, because he basically threatened them with the knife and they let go of him, which I understand for their own safety. And they said it was really spooky because he walked very calmly towards you. So this is a man who's just broken free of people holding him. He's midway through an attack, which is now starting to get attention. And he walked to me and he continued the attack. And he turned the knife to my wrist and to my baby bump. And then he held it to my throat. And at that point, an 18-year-old lad who'd been in the town centre by those bus stops I mentioned at the bottom of Trinity Hill came running up the hill and he rugby tackled the attacker off me. He didn't even know the attacker had a knife. He just rugby tackled. The attacker got to his feet, came at me for a third time, walking again, there's photos that were taken at the time. and police arrived on the scene. They'd been on foot patrol, they'd heard the screams. They came running and they arrested him just as he was over me with the knife. And that in total was a 9-minute attack, and I was stabbed 24 times and I was 8 months pregnant. So the longest 9 minutes of my life.
I don't think I've ever been moved by a story as much as I've been moved by that. You couldn't write it in some ways. And it has so many nightmare areas of walking down alleys, people coming up from behind, being hooded, seeing the knife before it came. I mean, it wasn't in a way plunged straight into your back. You were made to be held. He knew what he was doing. Mm-hmm. And where were you? You were stabbed all over in that first frenzied attack of 20.
But this is what is so bizarre. So, because I was actually airlifted at the town centre to the Queen Elizabeth Hospital, which is a major trauma centre in Birmingham, just by Birmingham City Centre. They have people from Afghanistan and things get flown back there. It's a very high-tech military hospital. We've got top trauma doctors there. When I was flown there, and obviously they had to work on me, I was put into theatre. But when I came around, I remember the doctors always saying to me, Natalie, the stab wounds were very accurate because I had 11 in my chest. So he hit the outside part of my heart. He hit my lung, which collapsed. He went to my diaphragm in two places and he went to my liver. He held me down and cut me through my artery and my wrist. And he went through the uterus. And they said everything was very, very focused. So if you imagine a frenzied attack, you'd think, I mean, I have got a slash down the side of my wrist, which I think is where I was trying to protect myself. But the cut that's through my wrist was actually that's the one that he held me down and he did that on purpose. But apart from that in the side of my wrist and one across my bicep, all of the rest of them were very targeted. And, you know, it didn't go in my legs, for example. You know, it didn't go repeatedly across my arms. It was all a very focused attack, and the hospital made that comment at the time that they said, was he medically trained? I said, no, he's a very intelligent man. He'd been to university and, you know, he's got a good education. He read a lot. And I said, but he's not medically trained at all. And they said, well, everything was very accurate. So it was very much a premeditated attack. Even the disguise that he wore added to the premeditation. He had four tops on. So the hooded top was the fourth layer. Under that fourth layer, he had a rucksack to pad himself out, which made him look a lot bigger. And in that rucksack, he had spare clothes, he had spare shoes. He had a black bin bag in his back pocket. He had two pairs of trousers on. He had two pairs of gloves. He had latex gloves and gardening gloves. So this is not somebody who's lost their mind in the kitchen, for argument's sake, in an argument, heat of an argument, heated, you know, and heated row. And this is somebody who's planned it out. He planned it out. The first 11 stab wounds were probably all in my chest, because I remember it was repeatedly in my chest, because I believe he was aiming for the heart, that I would go down and he was going to run. And that was clearly his plan. But same for him, that I'm like the Terminator and I didn't die.
Yeah, and you know what? Good on you. And it does sound incredibly... he'd obviously thought of exactly what to do before, bearing in mind he wanted you in the car before all this, before you made a decision that later turned out to save your life.
Yeah, the police have always maintained that the fact that he kept insisting that he's going to pick me up, we believe, obviously it can never be confirmed because we'll never know, but we believe that he was going to come and pick me up, not do it at the house because that would obviously lay it on him. But we'd quite often go to Sutton Park, which is a very nice big parkland. It's got lots of trees, and we'd quite often go walking there. There's a nice little coffee shop, and we believe he'd probably have taken me somewhere like that. He might have said to me, oh, the appointment's been cancelled, let's go for a walk, let's go and get a coffee. And he was probably going to do it somewhere like that, and I would have been one of those horrific stories you heard on the news, you know, where you hear body being found by dog walker or jogger or something. They believe he was going, that was his original plan. He got himself so psyched up for it that when I told him I'd left the house, he just thought he had to go ahead and just do it. The quietest point of my walk was Trinity Hill. He knew which way I was walking. As it turned out, when I made that phone call to him and he told me he was stuck in traffic, he was actually already in Sutton Town Centre. He'd arrived there earlier. He'd gone to Marks and Spencer's and bought his lunch and been caught on camera. He paid with his card. He went to the cash point, used his card. He made a digital footprint in Sutton Town Centre. Now, again, we think that he was then going to drive out of the centre because in the car park that had no CCTV, and he was going to come back, pick me up, do it, but then go back to the town centre, stand at the bank and probably go, well, where is she? You know, I've been here all this time. Because he'd left work, he needed an alibi as to where he was. So I think he'd gone as far as he left his work, place of work, he went to the town centre, made himself very visible on CCTV, using a card, everything else, a couple of transactions, so that he could have maintained, well, I was in the town centre the whole time. But actually, while he was in the town centre, I thought his plan by phoning and saying, oh, I've left. I've decided to make my way down.
Thank God you did.
And then I just think he just thought, I've got to do it. And that's when he made the choice to do what he did.
What was the compulsion, do you think, to do it irrespective of whether his plan was foiled? Was he facing a deadline or anything? Or was there anything that there wasn't a reason why he could change his plan and withdraw?
There was a couple of things. I believe that his plans were starting to unravel. So Bob had created this reality that everything was good with work, everything was fine and in control, and he was going to support me financially through my maternity leave. Now, I was very independent. I owned the house that we lived in. I had a mortgage, but it was all in my name. I'd put down the money for it from previous properties, and I'd got a good job. But my maternity pay was pretty rubbish. My pharmaceutical job was really well paid, but actually maternity pay was going to be quite low. So Bob had said he was going to give me this lump sum of money from a dividend he was getting from his work, because he was a director. He was going to get this dividend and he was going to put it into my account to help us pay, because I paid the mortgage, that it would help pay the mortgage while I was on maternity leave. Now, he kept delaying it and coming up with stories as to why this money hadn't transpired. And on that Friday, he reckoned that he'd got it and that it was sitting in his account and he just had to bounce it to my account. But we had to prove there's no money laundering, so we both had to go in to prove that he was bouncing this £20,000 to me and it was all legitimate. The fact was, he had £11.36 in his bank account as it came out when we got to trial. I found out afterwards he was being kicked out of his business. His co-director was kicking him out because he'd been taking money unlawfully from the business. And I think that he suddenly realised the baby was nearly going to be born, because they'd already had a scare the weekend before thinking she was going to be prem. And although he had pushed for us to have a child, he came from a family background from a different race and religion, and his mother didn't approve of our relationship. Now, he told me she knew I was pregnant. As it came out, she didn't know I was pregnant. So he's leading this life, going back to his mum, pretending that he's doing everything right by her, leading this life with me, pretending he can do what he wants and that he's got all this money behind him to support me. But everything was a lie. And I feel he thought, the baby might come this weekend. It's going to come out to my family that I'm lying, that I've got this child that I've not told my family about, and I've not got the finances. And I believe he just felt that he had to do it then. He built himself up for a couple of days. He'd got the knife a couple of days before as it came out. He'd got the clothes ready a couple of days before. He'd had them in the back of the car all that time. He was coming home as normal and all this stuff was sitting outside on the drive, you know, in the car. And I think he just didn't want to risk another day in case I had the baby and also I'd find out he had no money. And that really wouldn't have mattered.
There are two things I want to ask, because now we know all of that. If I can take you back to the incident, there was a time where, first of all, I want to ask you, quite honestly, what the feeling was like when you were on the floor, when he was walking up to you with his hood on, you couldn't move, and had it not been for that hero, that 18-year-old lad who saved your life, dread to think, what was going through your mind then at that precise point?
When he was walking towards me, there's a few things going on. Well, actually, there's a lot going on, obviously. The horrible realization that he was coming back towards me made me, it suddenly hit me, this man wants me dead. Which now sounds ridiculous because he'd stabbed me lots of times already, but the fact that he was coming to finish the job off, the pure fear of, this is it, this is actually it. And, you know, I'd gone from being in this happy bubble, getting up that morning, seeing my daughters in their assembly, and, you know, I've got a good job, good career, about to have a baby, everything all lovely with my partner, which I thought was all good because I had no reason for me to think anything different. And also I'm thinking, this is actually it, this is the end. And he was walking towards me. Now, as he first started walking towards me, a lot of people say to me, how did you not know it was him? It was your partner, how did you not know it was him? Well, first of all, he was very bulked up and he got the hood pulled right down. The second thing was, as he stood up to walk towards me, I caught a glimpse of his face. And for a split second, my head, and remember, I'm very dazed anyway, I'm bleeding profusely and everything else, but I remember thinking, oh, it's Bob. How does he know I'm here? And I thought he was one of the people who'd been trying to save me. And then I saw the knife and I thought, no, that's the man who attacked me. And well, it can't be Bobby because it's too fat. It must be a guy who looks like him. And then I started talking myself out of it. And when he pulled up in front of me, and he literally crouched down on the pavement in front of me and he held the knife to my face and he started punching me to knock me out. So he's punching me repeatedly. So I've got his knife in my face, he's punching me in the eye to knock me out before he continued the attack. And all that time I'm just thinking, but is it Bobby? No, it can't, no, it's not Bobby. And when I had my PTSD, so I had post-traumatic stress, obviously, from all the attack, and I had therapy for it. And when we went back into the attack, I said, why am I not looking at his face? And I was getting really angry with myself in my therapy, saying, he's in front of me, like you are almost in front of me in the screen, why am I not looking at his face? I can see what he's doing, I can see the knife, but why am I not looking at his face? And my psychologist said, because your brain probably had connected that it was him at this point. But the only way you could survive was to block it out and go into survival mode, that you just had to protect yourself against this attacker because you knew how serious it was. I mean, literally, you know, I knew that this was potentially the end and I had to give everything to it. It's like, you know, being in a training session thinking I've got to push to the end. It was like, I've got to throw everything at this. I cannot be distracted by who it is, because actually if I think about who it is, I'm going to emotionally break. You know,
let's face it, you were one more away from death, weren't you? He was lining you up to finish you off.
Oh gosh, yeah, completely. I mean, he actually had the knife was against my throat when the 18-year-old pulled me off. And as I always say to Callum, who's the 18-year-old who did it, who's so lovely, so down to earth, so like, oh well, it's fine. That I'm like, you've saved my life. You saved my baby's life. Saved my life. My daughters have got their mum because, you know, of what you did. And, you know, and I just said, if you had been 30 seconds later, a minute later, I still said, don't know to this day. There are quite a few people that heard the shouts for help in Sutton Town Centre. The Friday afternoon, you know, you think about it, it's 3:15 in the afternoon. He was the one person who responded. What caused him to run across the ring road? So we're talking, you know, three lanes of traffic he ran across. Then up Trinity Hill, rounded the corner, sees this man over a woman lying on the floor covered in blood, and he rugby tackled him straight off. No thinking, no second thought, just straight in, rugby tackled him. And I said to him, what caused you to do that? Other people have stood there, they can hear the same as you, but you chose to act. And he said, I don't know, I just thought someone needed help.
Well, he so
should it's incredible what people do. Yeah, he did. He got a bravery award. All three who jumped in on to save me, they all got commended bravery awards from the police, and they went to London, and they also had a ceremony up in the Midlands as well, and rightly so.
And rightly so. Absolutely. I know when I asked you this question before, I mean, the whole thing is horrifying. I've never sat in silence listening to a story. You've got all sorts of nightmares in one. You saw his face and you saw the blade and everything unfolded. It didn't necessarily hurt, did it? Because your emotions and everything and your body was kicking in, or did it? Did you feel certain?
The first couple of stab wounds hurt. It's like a burning pain.
Right.
But then, do you know what? It goes into, as you say, your body, the adrenaline that's flowing, the survival mode you go into, I could feel the blows, but a lot of people I know share the same thing, that they say it feels like you're being punched. And that's the best way to describe it. If you're being stabbed, it feels, because I've heard younger people who said they thought they were being punched in the back only to realize they've been stabbed, sort of thing. And then it just goes into that. I think my body completely, even, you know, towards the end when it was very, very calculated, all the stab wounds, I'd gone almost numb. Because again, it's all about our brain. It's all about the incredible effects of our brain. So my brain had made the decision to block out who it was because I needed to survive. My brain had also was now blocking out, I feel the pain, because it was almost too much to bear. So it was just focusing on, you've got to fight to stay alive. You've got to fight to stay alive. You've got to fight to stay alive.
And so the 18-year-old, sorry, what was the 18-year-old's name? He deserves me to mention
Callum.
Callum.
Callum Gibson, yeah.
Well, Callum Gibson. Saved your life, rescued the attacker that was your partner. Then did he hold him down and the police came? How did you realise that all this was over, and what was that feeling like?
So he threw him off and pinned him to the floor, but Bob managed to get up and get past him again and come over with a knife. Behind Callum, the police, I didn't realise there were three police officers on foot patrol in Sutton Town Centre. So I'm slumped on the pavement. There were images taken, which only I've seen and the police have seen and the judge has seen. They've never been released into the public domain. My mum is aware of them. She never wants to see them. So I've always made sure they're always kept with just the police. But there is a photo and I have seen it, and I'm slumped on the ground holding my bump, and I've literally just got my arm up like this and my head down, and he's standing over me. And they said as they rounded the corner, these three police officers, batons drawn, they saw him over with a knife, they pinned him to the ground. And all I remember hearing, I heard this running, saw us on these, I just remember black and bright yellow, because it was just obviously their best sort of thing, their jacket, yellow jacket thing, a high vis. And they pushed him down, and all I remember them shouting was, "It's over, mate." And that was those words, "It's over, mate," and thinking, at long last, you know, because I knew that it's the police. I got a police officer in front of me who was there going, "I'm Cassie, my name is Cassie, what is your name?" And she started talking to me, and she's pressing down on my chest with her bare hands. I don't think she even had gloves on at that point. She was just pressing down on the wounds, and she's trying to get someone else to get gloves for her, but she's just there trying to talk to me.
So that immediate part of your nightmare is over. And yeah. albeit you thought of that two or three times before and he broke free. So once you realised, well, yeah, you tell me in your words.
Well, because I could hear them struggling. I knew now they were police officers, and I could see at the corner of my eye, his feet were on the pavement. He was quite close to me at this point. And again, this is this whole thing in my brain blocking out. I didn't look across to see who it was that they were holding. All I kept an eye on was his feet. You know, I could just see these feet on the ground. I could see two police officers literally sitting on top of him. And while the police officer's talking to me, she's taking my name, she's taking my address, and I'm trying to keep this normality of trying to talk to her. And I remember saying to her, "Have they taken him yet?" And I could hear this scuffling noise. You see, so I think I was getting a bit panicked because I can hear the scuffling. I said, "Have they taken him yet?" And she says, "They're just taking him now." And then there's that sense of relaxation that he was being taken off, you know, they were taking him.
Yeah. And did you get eye contact at all? Did he look over? Was there any explanation?
No, I mean, he was just taken. They took him away from me the other way. I believe they pinned him against the door, which was in a building at this car park. I don't remember what they ever did, whether they walked past him with me. Because at this point now, they're tourniqueting my arm because my wrist is cut open. They're pressing my chest. I'm holding parts of me, and there's some very horrible details that I won't go into now, but I was having to hold different parts of myself at this point. So I've got my hand on my bump, trying to hold myself together. And I became fixated. I laugh now because it's so ridiculous. I have laughed with the police officer. I kept saying to the police officer, "But my handbag's up there," because when they started, I dropped my handbag. And I kept saying to my handbag's up there. And she's going, "Nasty, don't worry about it." I was going, "Yeah, but I need someone to get my handbag. My handbag's there." Natalie, don't worry, it'll be fine.
Yeah, and we've got more pressing matters.
She visited me in the hospital and she goes, all you'd go on about is your handbag. All you'd get away with, my handbag's up there. And it's apparently very normal that when we're in this traumatic state, we find something really normal to fixate on. And I had no idea. I mean, they were treating the whole place as a murder scene. They taped it off, you know, they got guys in white forensic suits, you know, and there I am, keep going, yeah, but my handbag, someone might take it.
Everyone's not making a fuss, it's fine.
Someone might nick my handbag.
When did it turn from survival, that you've survived, to my baby? What happened next?
So I'm holding on to my bump. They're doing all the first aid and they're telling me that an air ambulance is coming in for me. A land ambulance arrives and they transfer me. And that's when they first start asking me the question, Nasty, can you feel your baby move? Now, I think this is brain survival, I'd blocked out about the baby because he stabbed me directly into the stomach. He stabbed me 3 times in my stomach. So I'm obviously not wanting, I'm of the thought, deep down thinking, she's gone. There's no way that she can be alive. Nobody thought there's any way she could be alive. If I remember, I fell onto the pavement at the beginning of the attack, heavily. I've been stabbed repeatedly. I've fallen onto my bump halfway through, because when I passed out, when I got away, I passed out face first. He stabbed me directly into the bump. So I'm thinking there's literally no chance that this baby can be alive, no chance. And they said to me, can you feel her move? The first time I had to suddenly think, well, can I feel my baby move? No, I can't. And again, I tried to block it out. The air ambulance came. They asked me the same question. I remember being in the helicopter and saying, Nasty, can you feel the baby? And I'm saying, no. So they apparently, it was radioed ahead for them to expect a dead baby. That was horrible and it's hard. And that's it. It can still upset me now when I think about the fact they did radio ahead that they thought she was gone. They landed at the QE, they literally ran me to theatre, as in they were screaming straight to theatre. They pushed me into resus, they cleared 3 resus bays, there's 30 staff there. I didn't know off the time, I didn't count them, but they told me since there was 30 staff there. I just remember this room, and, yeah, I didn't do a head count. While I'm here, just count you all up. I'm
still thinking of your handbag.
Yeah. I've got your handbag still on that pavement. I think I was probably still obsessing about the handbag. So there's all these people in this room and they're starting to introduce themselves to me. I do remember that. So I've got the trauma doctor saying, hello, I'm Colonel K, because he's a military doctor. I'm going to look after you. But then he's getting the handover from the air ambulance. You know, as we see in these 24 hours in A&E program, they're getting the handover. So they're having a chat. And I have this obstetrician. And it's the only one I remember talking to is this obstetrician. And she's quite a small build Asian lady, she's very lovely, she's big smile on her face, obviously trying to be very calm to me, saying, Natalie, I'm going to deliver your baby. Now I'm lying down and there's no knife over putting this, her head was basically between my legs already, and I'm like, oh, hello, and his little face appears. It's like, hello, what are you doing down there? And she's going, I'm going to deliver your baby. And I was like, okay. When you're in theatre, because I knew they were taking me straight into theatre, they were literally about to knock me out, they're just preparing it to put the injection in. She said, I'm going to deliver in theatre. She goes, I'm just going to get this catheter in. Pardon? And I remember this little her smiling face, I'm like looking at her, and I can barely breathe. I'm on one lung, my right lung is now fully collapsed. So I'm like, trying to breathe. Actually, my skull, I'm going like that, like, no, you're not putting that catheter in, wait till I'm, you know, sort of thinking, wait till I'm out.
You've only got to wait a couple of minutes.
Yes, no, she went straight ahead and did it. And so I'm lying there thinking, oh, she's done it. And thinking, have I not gone through enough that this lady is smiling away at me is inserting a catheter? But bizarre the thing to remember, I'm there literally about to die. They reckon when we landed, I had less than 5 minutes left to live. That's how touch and go. They thought I was actually going to die in the helicopter. They didn't think I was going to survive the flight. No, I am worried about the fact that this obstetrician woman is going to stick a catheter in places you really don't want needles. But, and she did. So that's when I think about the baby, because it was reassuring, I suppose, when she spoke to me, because I thought, she said, I'm here to deliver your baby. To almost normalize it of, oh, I'm in a hospital and this lady is going, is the obstetrician, she's the specialist, and she's talking about delivering my baby.
That was the first good news you've heard for a while.
Yeah, it was almost like a real entity. What I didn't know is that she actually, even she was apparently thinking that they were going to be delivering a dead baby. And my daughter, when she was delivered in theatre, they had to work on me to start with because I was about to go, so they worked on me. They then opened me up to get her out quickly. And she wasn't breathing. She was pale. She was floppy. They took 5 minutes to resuscitate her. So it was a long time, really. Five different attempts. I thought that there's going to be no good. And all of a sudden, she came back round. She couldn't breathe properly. So they quickly, obviously, ventilated her, you know, intubated her. They put her into a coma straight away. And they rushed her to intensive care in a different hospital, because the QE hospital in Birmingham doesn't have maternity, they had to transfer her to the next door hospital, the women's hospital, and they cooled her body down for 3 days in a coma to help preserve her brain, because she'd been massively starved of oxygen. So,
how old is your daughter now?
So she's just turned four, and she's funny. She's defied every single odd, touch wood, but she has got a delay in her speech. We don't know learning wise, so she's due to start school in September. It could be that we find that she'll have some form of learning difficulties. She did have damage to her brain, and that's a fact, from the oxygen starvation. Obviously, the uterus wasn't supplying enough blood to her when during the attack, and then it took so long to resuscitate her. But she's funny, and even if she has got learning difficulties, it just doesn't matter. It's because she's the strongest character out of all my three, I think. And she's a blessing to the family because she's hilarious. She's hilarious.
And when you look at your daughter, obviously now you're incredibly blessed. Is there a part of you that still sees Bobby in your
daughter? Yeah, I mean, there's no denying that, because people do say this, you know, obviously she's 50% genetically him, there's no getting away from that, and I can't help but know that the reason I've got a third child is because he pushed and pushed and pushed first to have a child. You know, I'd got my two, I thought my childbearing days were over. I was 39 when I got pregnant, you know, with, as you just said at the beginning of this, I had a good job, you know, I was working in the pharmaceutical industry, great career. I wasn't thinking I was going to be having another child at this point, but he was desperate for a child because he hadn't got any. So you can't help but reflect and think, I've got this daughter because he wanted a child so badly, and we got pregnant, and then at 8 months pregnant it didn't suit him anymore, and he tried to kill us both, and we both survived, but now I'm here bringing up this baby on my own. And she's got a terrible truth to learn, you know, she knows parts of it. She doesn't know yet who did it, but she does know parts of the story. But it is tough. It is tough because, you know, she's got brown eyes. She's got brown hair. She doesn't need to fake tan like a mum. So she's got a very beautiful, darker complexion. And there is no getting away from who's her father, genetic father, shall we say, not dad, certainly not dad, but she's got her own personality, and she's got a lot of my characteristics.
Yeah, good, and they shine through, believe me. You're going to have that conversation at some point, and it's better coming from you. I presume you've thought of this daily rather than the playground or something. How are you?
And that's my biggest fear. You know, we live in a digital world. I have an unusual surname. You know, it's not hard to find me on the internet, shall we say. If you put Natalie Kerrott into Google, it's bing, 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 bing. You've probably seen it yourself. It's there. And it says very clearly that it was my partner, you know, so she will know that the person who is her genetic father, parent, is the person who did it. What she does know, she knows that the day that the day she was born, that mummy was hurt very badly, that mummy had to get flown in a helicopter, and she was in mummy's tummy when we went in the helicopter, because I do a lot of fundraising for Midlands Air Ambulance Charity, who airlifted me. So she knows red helicopter, I've got one even sat in front of me on my desk, but she says, Red Helicopter is Mummy, and that's what happened, that Mummy was very poorly, and that she was poorly, and she was born that day, and we were both in hospital, but now we're better. She recently learned that, she asked me, my hands got quite badly damaged in the attack, so the tendons were cut to my thumb and my little finger. My little finger's now permanently in this position. It got fused. I might have to have it amputated at some point, and that's because it's starting to contort quite badly. And I've got scars all over, which is why I wear terrible fake tan, which is why I'm a bit patchy looking at times. But she was asking about the marks on me. She's going, why is Mummy's hand like that? She's going, Mummy hand, and pointing to my fingers. And she noticed, you know, the marks. So I did say, well, Mummy had cuts on her, cuts from a knife. Now, knives can be good, but some people use knives for bad things, and some use a knife for a bad thing on Mummy. So she knows that part as well. And it's bit by bit, but my biggest fear is exactly what you say, is somebody in the playground going, your dad tried to kill your mum the day you were born. And so I've still got to progress the conversation before there's that risk, because people know who I am, they know the story. She's now picking up conversation, so if people mention it when she's around, she's getting switched on to know and hear conversations. And I've been told to tell her at a young age. People might say, oh, don't tell her yet, but I've referred to child psychologists. They say, tell her at a young age. It's that sort of mentality. She grows up with it as her norm, as awful as it is as a norm. But it's not quite so bad. You won't want to be 10, 14, 15. We're talking about our own children, you know. Think of a teenager. You don't want to suddenly break the news to her then, you know. Yeah.
And I guess as a mum, bless her, the time will naturally present itself to you when you least expect it, maybe, and it'll be a deep breath, and then you'll come out with your own messaging around the event.
It's true, because I've written a book. I'm not plugging here. Not plugging.
I wouldn't mind if you were.
I have my book. So I have a book still standing. On the front cover is a photo of myself and her as a baby. She knows, she just saw this as I picked it up to do this. She actually said, oh, that's me and Mummy. Because that's me and Mummy. Now, I've never really told her that, but she knows full well that on the cover is me and Mummy. And I said, okay. I said, well, who wrote that book? And she said, I don't know.
just hold that book up again, because I don't think there's anyone that you'd have... any moment in your life that will be as precious as that? Is there that after what had happened to you, you thought that moment may never happen?
No, exactly. And, you know, this was, weirdly, this photo was taken as a selfie. I was on my sofa. She was 3 months old, I think, when I took this photo. And we were just there, she was on my chest, and I just took this selfie of her on me, because I was very aware that being a single parent, that there was nobody else to take photos of us. My mum did come and live with us for the first 6 months after the attack. She's been an amazing support. I never thought at 40 years old I'd have my mother living with me, but I needed it. I got three kids, and my mum is incredible woman, very strong woman, and she was a lifesaver. But my mum's no good with technology, so if I ask my mum to take a photo, she's going, yeah, how do I do this?
I
used to take a lot of photos, selfies and photos of myself holding her, and because I wanted it, that memory. And it is a very precious moment when I look at that, you know, that it's just one of those poignant moments.
Okay, so I've got to ask, from your recovery, the judicial system would have been in full flow. What was the outcome?
He pleaded guilty, as he had to. It was like, oh, well done, he's pleaded guilty. I'm like, well, he was caught standing over me with the knife by three police officers. There's literally red-handed, and he was literally red-handed.
Oh, bless you.
And you can get much more in the literal sense. He pleaded guilty to attempted murder of me. He pleaded guilty to attempted child destruction, they call it, because she was in the womb, so it's child destruction. He pleaded guilty to assault, like grievous bodily harm, of two of the passers-by, John Mitchell and Tony, the first two guys, because he got into quite a fight, and the knife actually caught John in the hand. So as he was flashing the knife back, it caught, and he did stab him across his hand. and carrying a knife in public. So lots of horrific charges. It's all classed as very premeditated, and he was a dangerous man because there'd been literally no warning. You know, he'd been at work that morning, totally normal, chatting to his colleague. So the fact that nobody could see this coming, we're all expecting quite a large sentence. He got sentenced in the end, it got down to 18 years. Started about 13, we got down to 18, to serve a minimum of 12. So potentially in 8 years' time, because he's now done 4 of those years already, potentially in 8 years' time, he's eligible for parole.
How do you feel about that?
That's horrific. It is horrific. And that's the hardest thought. He'll never come after me. I don't believe, he's got no reason that. The reason to kill me has gone. As weird as that sounds, but it has gone. My biggest concern is around my daughter, because obviously she will be a teenager, just coming up to her teenage years, or she'll be 12, 13, coming on 14, so coming to teenage years. And the thought is, they say, oh, but we'll put a restraining order in. Well, a restraining order is a piece of paper. It doesn't physically stop him sitting outside her secondary school, if he finds us, and waiting for her. So very, very hard. I wish it had been 18 and it'd be 18 minimum, because at least you'd have been an adult when he came out. Very difficult. Personally, I don't agree with the sentence that he got for the horrific nature of the attack. I'm only here by grace of God or whatever, because nobody can understand how I'm alive with the injuries that I sustained. Yeah. Nobody can understand how my baby's alive. It just doesn't seem right.
No, and you really want it to be over, full stop, not over, and I'll pick it up and worry about it in another six years.
And that's the thing, is it, victims of attacks like this, we get a life sentence as well. They might go to prison, but actually I have a life sentence because he's still around,
So following that and the goes to court and is found guilty, clearly, how do you come to terms with it? Moving forward, how you've obviously had some therapy, you've found that health and fitness has helped you get your mind straighter. How have you reevaluated life since?
When we talk about life-changing moments, this is a completely life-changing moment. I remember sitting in the hospital, having got over the critical stage, because critical myself for many days, and I remember sitting there and I thought, crikey, if I had died on that hill, which I was very close to doing, I would have died doing, and this is no disrespect to the company that I worked for, they're a fantastic company, supported me massively, but I knew it wasn't my heart's desire. Mm-hmm. I'd got into a career and a life which actually paid very well, carried, it's a lovely thing in terms of to say, this is what I'm doing, I was proud of the job, but fundamentally, I wasn't doing a job that I enjoyed. It wasn't paying to my actual true values. And I thought, I could have died working my absolute ass off, going away a lot, staying in hotels, not seeing my kids as much, earning a really good salary, but actually, was it worth it? And it made me totally reevaluate what was actually important, because we all talk about life could be taken away in a moment, and it's true. I never knew, as I was sat in that assembly that morning, when I went to the gym, when I went shopping, that my life could have been over within a few hours. And we have to live life. Yes, we have bills to pay. Yes, we have the mortgage to pay. We have stuff to consider, but we can still live. I truly believe we all need to reflect, what is our true value in life? I discovered that the part of my job that I liked when I was in pharmaceuticals was when I heard the patient's story. So especially when I worked in cancer care drugs, and I would help a patient who had got, access to funding and things, so a patient could get our drug. When I heard back from the doctor, well, this patient now, she's such and such with her family, blah, 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 and this drug's now given her years we didn't expect her to have, that really made a difference to me. So I suddenly realized my value was actually making a difference, a positive impact on other people's lives. And sounds cheesy, sounds corny, but that kind of has shaped where I've gone since. And I work a lot with young people now and youth violence and knife crime. And I realized that having the status and having the really well-paid job wasn't actually everything. What really brings us in this world is being able to feel that makes me feel good inside, that you know, I'm together with my family and I feel good about what I do. And it all sounds very corny and it sounds very...
No, do you know what? It doesn't sound corny. It's a shame that it takes an event like that for us all to realise. Imagine if we could all realise that now, what a better place the world would be, maybe.
And I wonder whether Corona will do that. This whole coronavirus has COVID. Will COVID have given a few of us a chance to stop and reflect? And we all rush around, we have to, but has it forced some of us to reflect? Some of us might end up, unfortunately and tragically, losing jobs, losing loved ones even more tragically, but, you know, financially in a different situation where we suddenly have to survive on a different finance. But that different finance might give us that perfect path, reason to go, do you know what, I can do something different. And I hope that has that positive effect on people.
And I think it will. It's that re-evaluating. Now, when you came out, when you start to think, right, I'm going to try and lead a normal life, whatever trying and normal is, you found it quite hard. There were some people local to you who still wanted to stick their two penny in.
Lots of people like to stick their two penny in. go on.
No, I was just asking about that and trying to get back to normal.
Yeah, so I'm there. You have a decision to make. I come out of hospital, I could lie on the sofa and cry, I could have curled up in a ball, or I could get up, I could put my makeup on, I could get dressed, I could be mom, I could try and function, and that's what I had to do. As far as I was concerned, that was my only route forward, was to get up, get dressed, be normal. Put on the face, put on maybe... Maybe that's where my sales background really came to play, because no matter how much hurt I felt inside, I would put on this game face, as we talk about, and I would step outside. The problem is that then seems to give people a path to say, I'm going to say to you whatever I feel like. And because you've had a trauma, which has been quite public, it was on the news, it was in the newspapers, especially locally, it was a massive story. So people felt, maybe they felt really connected and at ease with the story. Therefore, they would say all sorts of things. So I had one person say to me in the street, you're so brave, you're so strong, Natalie. I'm glad it happened to you. Well, because you're the strongest person I know. And I don't know if anyone else I know would have survived that. But it's good that it happened to you, because you are the person who could survive it. If anyone can survive it, it's you. It kind of obviously was a compliment, but at the same time I'm going, oh gee, well that's okay then, because I've got this face on and you think that I'm surviving this, but I'm actually broken, but I keep smiling. I had people speculate why he'd done it. That was obviously a great point of discussion for some people. And my neighbour at the time, she decided it was perfectly okay to ask me as I came home with carrying the little one in her car seat and chatting to her for the first time. Now, bear in mind, this woman had lived next to Bobby and I, she'd seen us as a couple, she'd seen how happy we were, or I thought we were. And then she's just chatting to me and she goes, totally out of the blue, so is she his child? And, pardon? Sorry, am I in Jeremy Kyle for a second? I'm not quite sure where I am. And she said, well, you know, she said, just met Big the Hunt. She goes, well, you know, people have been talking about why he did it, and we all just wondered whether the baby actually wasn't his and that's why he tried to do what he did. I was like, for a split second, I then go into defense mode and start saying, no, he accepts it's his child and it's the child that he wanted and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
I think, what am I doing? Why exactly am I justifying this? And I just went in the house. Trauma is a weird thing. I feel that it allows people to say, it's something I talk about actually in the book I've got a bit about it. People feel they've got this green card. So people would say to me, oh, you've lost so much weight, Natalie. And then the flip side, well, it's good to see you've put a bit of weight back on, Natalie. Mm. Pardon?
Yeah.
At no point is it acceptable or happy to tell a woman she's put on weight, okay? Yes. Even if I've been in a bad place, I do not go to you or any of my friends and say, do you know what? Oh, it's good. Oh, you've put a bit of weight on.
Lovely to see. That is. Oh, that's nice. That is. Well done.
But people just felt that anything was an acceptable thing to say, you know. Oh, yes, excuse me, I could go, oh, yeah, well, you did look like shit.
Yes, that's right, cheers.
I had been stabbed 24 times and had a child, so funnily enough,
it may have been that.
My best.
It may have been that. How the next question is moving on, because I want to know after the event, what was your lowest moment? And this is after, you know, when the lights have gone off and you're on your own. And yeah. And I'm not just asking that for my own interest. I'm asking that because many others will resonate of low periods in their lives. And I'm interested in how you got out of it.
I think the low periods, they just kept coming in waves. And I think people will appreciate that when you get into that. It's sort of, you have this overall low and then there's times where it's overwhelming. And I think, I was in critical care, then I was in major trauma, and everything was so crazy. There was almost no chance to think about it. When they moved me to the other hostel where my daughter was, and I was put together with her for the first time, I remember sitting there, it's night. I've got one arm completely bandaged up. I've got a newborn baby, which I've only got one hand to use, and I've got to feed her, and she doesn't feed very well, because she still can't swallow properly. And it all just hit me like a train. You know, I'd got police coming in the day. I'm in a hospital room and they're doing video interviews with me. And you just think, I'm in this absolute nightmare. It's like this nightmare. And it's like, it's just beginning. I can't see a way out. Because at this point, you cannot see a way out. You cannot see how life can be any different. And when I got back home, again, it was the waves. We lived together. So I'd be opening the wardrobe and these clothes were there, you know, and I had all of that to have to pack up and put away, because I did tell everyone, just leave, that I want to pack it all up. And those low moments were very hard and frequent. And the first few months when I was back at home and my mum was living with us, I remember saying to my mum, don't leave me alone. And I was so scared. I had morphine. I had various other, you know, sort of drugs for all different pain relief and for the different stab wounds and nerve blockers. And I had enough that I could have finished myself off so easily. You know, I had so many drugs in the house. I could have just taken the lot and left the world.
Did it ever cross your mind?
Yeah, it did. It did. I was so scared to be left alone because I didn't trust myself that if I was left alone, there's no one there to stop me. Yeah. What I soon realised is there is something there to stop me, and that was my kids. So from the moment the attack had happened, all I could think about was my two older kids. When I was in the helicopter, all I could think about was my two older kids, because I had to block out about the baby. Once I'm in the hospital, I've now got three children, and one of them's a very poorly little baby. And whenever it hit me, that dark moment, and I did battle with suicidal thoughts, you know, I'm very honest about that, I never attempted it, but I did battle with it. The only thing that held me on this earth was my children. And it was the thought that I have a responsibility. I am a mom. I have three kids. It would devastate them. It would devastate my whole family. Well, at least I hope it would. You know, you hope they would devastate your family. Maybe not. I don't know. Certainly I've upset them. Probably devastate your family. But I thought about the kids and the fact that when I visualized what my children would be like if they were being told that I died, that was so painful to me that overcame the desire to finish myself. And that was the only thing that held me. And I sympathize anybody who's going through suicidal thoughts, tendencies, that very dark place. One, I completely empathize with you because it's so awful. It's such an awful place to be in. But it's focusing in on that one, if you can just envisage that one thing, that one person or whatever it is, that one thing that you just think, that this is what, you know, will be gone. It could be that there might be an auntie, a granny, your mom, your sister, a sibling, a best friend. But it's that one person that you just think, they would be so devastated. Now, some people obviously feel that there's no one, but if we all think hard, there will always be one person that you could think, this would absolutely destroy their life.
Natalie, there's going to be lots of people watching this due to the audience that it goes out to that will have had those thoughts, and some who may still be having those thoughts. So I thank you for being so frank. You're normalizing the conversation around depression and suicide, and that is the only way if we're going to ever help people.
Because you have to, it's taking that next step. And you know what? The one thing I found is when I got through it, and sometimes I'd have to just go to bed and sleep. because it's almost like I was exhausted, and we all know it's that mental exhaustion. Your head's been processing. You get to that desperation. I might have gone for a run, that might have helped, or it might be that I just needed to go to sleep. What you should always do is, when you've got through one of those, is to go back and you should reflect on it and congratulate yourself that you've got through it. And so the next time you get to it, you think, I know I can get through this. I know I can get to the next day, and I can be glad that I've made it through another day. And it's always embracing the fact, be proud of yourself that you've got through every one of those dark moments, and be proud of it, and use it to help you to get through other dark moments.
And so the lowest moment really was that period when you were on your own with the wardrobes, with everything around you on the way.
Yeah, and just looking and thinking, this is just awful. I was physically broken, I was mentally broken, and it was hard, you know. I thought about suicide, you know, on a number of occasions for, you know, a number of months. It wasn't something that went away quickly, but I started to do gratitude, which I thought was very sort of hippie-like from my wonderful counselor. And that's the other thing, that's my other life there, to be fair, my psychologist. My psychologist, from the moment I was in hospital, I was allocated a psychologist who I saw for 3.5 years. I never thought I'd see a psychologist for 3.5 years. I always thought, I don't need that kind of help. I'm a qualified coach, so why the hell I thought I was above being coached or counseled, I'm not quite sure. But but my psychologist was incredible. And she got me doing gratitude. And she said, I want you, in your really dark times, I'm going to force you to write down 3 things that have happened that day that you're happy about. Even if it's really hard, no matter how small they are, you write them down. And every single day I did it. And at first I was writing it down again. Excuse my language, I was like, this is a load of bollocks, I'm doing this. And then, but I'm being honest, I'm a terrible cynic about it all. But it was true. And then every day you could think, actually, that isn't so bad. And actually there are things. And you start getting into that mindset of pulling out something tiny, if it has to be, but 3 things every single day. What are you happy about today? And so when we're in, especially tough time in COVID, because it's hard, people don't know if they're going to lose their business. They don't know if they're going to lose their job if they're employed by another employer. You know, we don't know when we're going to be fully let out, which, you know, as it were. We don't know when our kids are going to go back to school. There's so many uncertainties, and it is going to get to people at the moment. You know, I have moments where you're suddenly getting to, oh my gosh, what's going to happen with my business? But you just think about those things. What are those things that we can be grateful for, even if it's a small thing?
And you've proved that they are there, however bad you feel. Now, tell me, when you know this day-to-day survival, which you were going through, which must have felt, a day must have felt like a month sometimes. When did it turn into, rather than survival, I don't know how loud your inner critic, with me, my inner critic was roaring. It was a right pain in the ass. It was a bully. I had to conquer it. It just kept picking on me. And for me, I had to talk about it because, you know, it got stronger with silence. So like with any anxiety, if you talk about it, it takes the bully's power away. But I can't imagine what you were going through. When did the day-to-day survival turn into giving yourself permission to actually think there was more to life, that you may even actually start to enjoy yourself again?
Yeah, and it was hard. You hit the nail on the head. You suddenly have this thing of, you could laugh about something. I mean, I've got a terrible sense of humour. I've got a very dark sense of humour. And anyone who knows me knows that. I say the most inappropriate things about myself. I even sort of self-deprivation, but that's dark humour. And I, you know, I've even made jokes about things I've gone through just because that's my way of dealing with it. But you could laugh about something, or you would suddenly be enjoying something. And someone might say to you, oh, it's good to see you smile. It's good to see you laugh. And then all of a sudden in your head you're going, oh, but then hold on, but then if I'm laughing and they're thinking I'm all right, well then they might not think that it's so bad what I've been through, and actually that it belittles what I've gone through, and actually should I be laughing, or should I still be having this sad face on because, you know, I've gone through this horrific thing. And it is horrible, because, and eventually it was again my psychologist that helped me, and she said, you know, be kind to yourself. And we hear this a lot on social media at the moment, the whole be kind to others, be kind to yourself. But it's so true. the biggest part of well-being is to start with yourself, and it's being kind to yourself. Allow yourself that time out if you need it. Allow that whatever you need to nurture. You have to nurture your soul, and you have to allow yourself to be happy regardless what anyone else thinks.
Yeah.
Because if you can get your own inner positivity, that will then go out to positivity to others. And when my psychologist was saying, but if you allow yourself to relax and to be happy, and you know what, embrace that small moment, because you know what, you'll probably have a hard moment the next day, so don't worry if you know you can allow yourself that time off. But allow yourself that nurture, that self-nurture, because it'll make you a better mom, you know, it'll make you happier. And it took a long time. It took a long time because it took me so long to accept anywhere what happened. The actual acceptance point of things took so long. It took years for me to accept it all. But my post-traumatic stress therapy helped, seeing that my psychologist so often helped. And eventually I got to the point where I was like, okay, I can be happy. And to the point that I have a partner. Yeah. And I, 4 years on, I have a partner, and a partner who proposed to me on New Year's Eve. You know, we've been together over a year, and but it took until I'd start properly accepted everything that I allowed myself and thought, no, I have a life, I'm alive, I'm alive for a reason, and damn it, I'm going to allow myself to be happy.
You're bloody right too. And where are you now on a 1 to 10 in terms of happiness?
Apart from having the challenges of COVID and business, I think in family terms I'm at a 10. In terms of my the most important people in my life, my children being are always number one, and my children are aside when they're doing homeschooling, that can make it more of a 7, I'll be honest. But
to a high six.
Homeschooling is hell. And when you're trying to do your own working out, Mom, how do I do this math? And I have no idea. But Mom, you went to I know, but I still don't know. I don't know how you do that. With my family, it's a 10. I've got a beautiful family. I've got a kind family, my wider family, my sisters, my mom. I've got a lot to be grateful for and a lot to be happy for. And that's the most important thing.
Yeah, and I feel like clapping. Well done, honestly. So you've had all that and you're a 10 now. I've got two more questions for you. So in everything that you've learned, how do you define well-being? What's your definition? I'm asking everyone because it differs with everyone. And also, you've been through it. What have you learned from that experience that you can give as a takeaway to anyone that's listening? That obviously doesn't have to need to go through all that in order to reevaluate what they're going through or their life.
Yeah. So with the well-being to me, it literally means it starts within. It starts with your self-nurture. It's well-being is about saying, I deserve to be happy. I deserve to give myself that break. And whatever that is that's going to nurture me, whether it's going to the gym, whether it's having that time out of spa day, whether it's that time out with a friend, whether it's that conversation. The most important thing I need to do for all of my life to work is it needs to start from within my happiness and my mental balance. And it's always important for us to go back to what is our mental balance, especially when we're in stressful jobs. We have to go back. If I'm not right in here and within here, then everything else will be an act. And at some point that act will fall apart. But if I have this together, then I can make clear decisions in my work life and in my personal life. That's well-being to me. And as for my takeaway, please, I beg everybody, reflect on what's your true value. What is your true inner value? And it might be that you want to build this, invent this, and you know what your value is? You want to be this creative, this pioneer. Great, go for it. It might be, as it is for me, I want to help others. I want to make a change. So I'm working in youth violence. So I want to empower people. I want to coach people to live their best life. Whatever that value is, you can work towards it. Doesn't matter what your bills are, what your mortgage is, what your job situation is. We can all do something today that starts us on a path to do more of the stuff that we value. Don't wait for a life-changing moment to start doing what you truly value.
Natalie, you're one of these people that I feel as if I've known for ages. You have such a gorgeous way of being able to tell your message. Your delivery is excellent. I can see you on stages all around the world, uplifting people and giving people hope, and for trying to find a reason why all this happened. You have such a natural gift. I can't thank you enough for giving us so much time today. And look, where can everyone find you?
I have a website. If you look up on www, and it's Q Inspire. So Q, the letter Q, that's from my surname, Kairosh, and Inspire, qinspire.co.uk. On there, it's got different media things that I've done. There's contact forms, and you can get a hold of me through there. If you want to learn more about my story, as I say, she says, famous look, still standing. It was called I'm Still Standing until my publisher pointed out that Sir Elton John would probably sue my ass off, so I had to change it to Still Standing. But I do love that song, and it's actually my ringtone. If you're ever in a shop and you suddenly hear someone with Elton John, I'm Still Standing, and now you see a bit like me, you know it's me. Look around, I'm around. So I have that, and if you want to hear more of my story, see me on my feet doing it. I did a TEDx in December, so if you go onto the TED channel, go onto YouTube, put on Still Standing, Make It Count, which obviously the whole theme of it being, don't live your life just with a second ticking away, you know, can make it count now, don't wait. And there's a repeat of the story and the highlights of it all on there.
You're an absolute legend. Is there anything else that you want to add?
I just feel that people, allow yourself to be happy, and it's really hard sometimes to allow ourselves to be happy because we get very fixated in our work world and we feel that we need to be a certain way. We may feel we need to be hardened, especially if you want to go progress into higher. We don't, you know, be happy, embrace others, be kind, and you know, I know that sounds a load of cheesy gump, but and I don't do cheese, but it's true.
Yeah, and I think what with all the current situation we're in at the moment, we're all level, we're all normal, there is no hierarchy. It's such a such a time to reevaluate, and I'm sure a lot of people will after they watch this.
Yeah, oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you ever so much, and we will do our best to direct people towards you and of course the charity that you've raised so much money for.
Yes, Midlands Air Ambulance Charity. On that note, Air Ambulance Charities up and down the country, they all rely on charitable donations. What people don't realise is the ones within England are completely charity led. Wales and Scotland do get support from the government, however they still have a massive charity angle. They still need support, they still need donations. Charities are going through a really tough time at the moment. With COVID, we know that fundraising generally has gone down. Thank goodness the NHS has had some brilliant fundraising. Yeah. Captain or Colonel Tom Moore has done an amazing job. But your air ambulance is out there still every day, especially you know, if you're in more remote areas and things like that. But regardless, that air ambulance could be the difference between you living, you don't, a family member making it till tomorrow. They need donations, so please look them up, get involved with online donations, do crazy challenges. I've done lots of crazy challenges. When we're allowed outside, put money in the boxes that you see, but please look at your air ambulance charity.
Yeah, and I've seen some of your social pages, and look, next time you do one of those runs or one of those Tough Mothers or whatever it is you're doing, or getting all dressed up, and look, invite me along. I'd love to do
it.
We'd love to share the word with Wellity. We'd love to get as many people there as possible.
Yeah, air ambulance charities are incredible. So yeah, definitely.
All right. Well, look, thank you for your time. I'll stop the recording now. We'll stay on the line, and you've been amazing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.